Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Dalitz.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Dalitz, editor-in-chief of the Science of Psychotherapy magazine, and I'm here with my faithful managing editor, Richard Hill. Howdy, Richard.
My faith is continuing with great strength and enthusiasm, and still here. Good to see you, Matt.
Good to be here, and welcome everybody. Today, we're going across to the United States and we're going to talk about anxiety.
Yes, my good friend, Reed Wilson, who has become a friend over the last decade or so through the Milton Erickson Foundations, but he's also been an enormous assistance to me in dealing with my understanding and with clients and various things. So he's great. Tell us a bit about Reed.
Right. Yes. So he's a licensed psychologist. He's the author of Stopping the Noise in Your Head and his classic self-help book, Don't Panic. He's co-author of Stopping Obsessing, as well as Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents. He's designed American Airlines' first national program for the Fearful Flyer and currently serves as the expert on anxiety for WebMD's mental health community. He's appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show, Good Morning America, CNN, lots of different places. He has a wonderful website full of great information called anxieties.com, and it serves millions of people every year. And he was saying that they've had that website for many years and they're the top go-to place for anxiety. So worth checking out if you haven't checked that one out.
Yeah, wow, he's a pretty important guy. How did I get to know him? That's fantastic. Yeah. I'm very fortunate.
I was saying to my wife that we're going to talk to Reed Wilson. She said, I saw him on Hoarders, American TV show.
TV show.
Yeah. So there you go.
But he's a great fellow, and I've always find it so interesting as I got introduced into psychotherapy and through the Erickson Foundation that the wonderful people that they're embracing, Reed is one of them, and Michael Yapko we've talked to before, who just sort of said, oh, yeah, good on you, come on. You'll find him very, very personable and very, very dry-witted. Let's go have a talk to Reed.
Dr. Reed Wilson, welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. So great to have you here.
Well, thank you, Matthew.
And it's Richard here. Nice to see you or hear you. It's fantastic.
Good to see you again. I actually get to see your face. Nobody else can see you at the moment, but I can.
Yes, it's the magic of Science of Psychotherapy podcast when it's being recorded.
Yeah.
Matthew, I know this, but others, Reed Wilson is somebody I got to know through the Milton Erickson Foundation conferences. And so we go back 10 or 15 years. It's really good. And Matthew was very important. There are a few things I want to bring up. Reed, just sort of getting in, we've said a few things about you, but you've got this amazing website, anxieties.com. You like people to have more than one. And
anxiety.com was already taken.
Yes, we all use dashes and dots. We are the science of psychotherapy because the science. it gets an enormous number of hits. People come in. You've got a bunch of things we want to talk about, videos, all kinds of stuff you've done recently. Kind of, how did that all come about? How long have you had this website? How long have you been doing this stuff? Just fill people in on a bit of the personal Reed Wilson perspective.
Sure. Well, I'll go back just a little bit around my training. I have pretty esoteric training, mentors from afar, Milton Erickson and the MRI Institute, the Fritz Perls, Eric Byrne. I mean, all these folks that young people today don't know anything about. I have a lot of training in Gestalt treatment and family systems treatment and group treatment. And my first career was in sexuality, actually. My second career was in chronic pain. I treated people in an inpatient therapeutic community. But that's when I started learning skills like relaxation, meditation, hypnosis for people with pain. Then in the late 70s, the media started talking about agoraphobia, women who live in their houses are afraid to go out, and people just came in through the woodwork in terms of wanting psychotherapy and treatment. And so I had a leg up because I knew some of these kind of skills, and then discovered really they were insufficient general kind of skills. And so then I was looking around the literature and very little is written. You know, you and I, when we went to school, the only thing we got around anxiety was treatment of phobias. And so, you know, there was really no literature out there. And so I was a young Turk and said, oh, I'll write a book on this and I'll learn it. And 6 months later, it'll be all done. And that was, you know, it took 3 years. Every book I've ever written all took 3 years. So I really cut my teeth on panic disorder. I met up with Edna Foa at conferences, and we decided to write a self-help book together on OCD called Stop Obsessing. And my whole career has really been on self-help. That's what I focus on. And we talk a little bit about stepped care in health and mental health work, and step care is like the first block of that self-care is giving people information, inexpensive ways to learn things quickly, and a certain percentage of those people will get better. And so that's what I keep going back to, trying to deliver things to consumers, and also to make them educated consumers so they don't get to the wrong place. So anxieties.com came up. I probably started about 16 years ago. I mean, the internet was just a baby when we started doing this, and it's grown pretty big. We are probably the largest self-help site on anxiety and OCD, and in the internet, we get 750,000 people a year coming on there to look and learn and so forth. And so I've taken a bunch of clips of working with clients and some of my teaching circumstances and made them nice and tight and 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 minutes long, and have posted them there as well. And people tend to like those.
Well, we're on the topic of the website, so you've consolidated a lot of your teaching into this sort of one-day course, haven't you?
I have. And that step care approach, I feel like, you know, all the stuff we're giving away for free is very helpful. And the next level up, I think, is something like what I also have just put out last year, about a 4.5-hour course on self-help for all the anxiety disorders and OCD, and you know, it's like less than the cost of a half a session with a therapist. And I think it really helps, again, get people on board with what they have to accomplish. I am a cognitive therapist, so I'm, you know, if you saw my hands now, you'd see me go, I go up. I want to step back away from the problem, step back away from the topic that they're focused on, and up to the disorder itself, because most of these disorders distract the person, so to speak, with the topic. And if we're going to treat the disorder, we better get up to the disorder level. And so when you get up at the level of the disorder, it's not that complex. It's right. Hard, but there are only so many moves that you need to make, and only so many moves the disorders go, you know, push against you to control you.
Yeah. I just want to highlight that, because it's been one of the things that's been a guiding light for me in the years. It's hard, but not complex, or not complicated. And that's, now I'm going to under describe this so you can have the wings to make proper sense of it. But one of the things, and I've spoken to you about this, that you were enormously helpful with me and my mother, who was suffering late onset anxieties because of oncoming and growing dementia and various other issues of aging. And one of the things is, possibly this is something Erickson, because he used to talk about this as well, that there's a degree to which the nature of the anxiety you're experiencing is self-created. So it has a self-creation element into it. And if you can show the person that they're creating it by getting them to make it a little worse, that you can then very quickly say, well, if you've managed to make it from a 7 to an 8? Can you make it now from an 8 to a 6? And I immediately put the caveat, in case you do it, don't ever do that with someone who's at a 9, because once I did that once, and that was that's right. But this aspect, so because Matt and I are great believers in self-regulation and self-education, and that the client does most of the work themselves. But they don't do it. Clients can't do work from a black box, you know, a dark room. So, having said those sorts of disparate elements, does that trigger a conversation from you to make sense of that more?
Sure. I said I was a cognitive therapist, but really, between you and I, I'm a strategic therapist, and right. That really does come out of MRI and second order change and Milton Erickson and others. And what I look for is, what's the pattern? What is the pattern that the disorder is using to control you? And let's learn as much as we can about our challenger, and then once we know the pattern, let's mess with it. That's a clinical term. Do I need to define that? You got that, right? We just, you know, it's like whatever you're doing right now, if it's not working, try anything else. But we are, this is a paradoxical treatment. And so, you know, part of what I drill down about with people is you need to want what you don't want. You need to want to go into the territory that's now dominated by the disorder and get your butt handed to you occasionally in order to win this whole thing. This is an aggressive sport. And so, you know, I'm going to mess with that pattern because the disorder basically is going to, it's not just going to give me symptoms, but it's going to give me symptoms, and I have to play the proper role for it to beat me. And the proper role is when I experience those symptoms or those obsessions, those urges, I need to try to push them away and get rid of them. And so that, you know, if I can get people to understand that, you know, first thing they have to understand is whatever the topic is that they think this is about, it's not that.
Yeah.
If we can understand that piece, and which is really a hard sell for some people, and once we can get that, and then I gotta, you know, understand that it wants me to back away, and my job is to pull it toward me. You know, I eat anxiety for breakfast. Is that all you got? I can handle this. You know, so that's the direction that I try to get people to move into.
Okay, so I've got step one. What is the pattern? Step two, mess with it. Sounds simple enough?
That's good. Yeah. So, and you know, I have this book called Stopping the Noise in Your Head, and the way I kind of step through it with them is I say the first step when we talk about that is to step back. So that's what we're talking about here. You step back and get perspective around what's going on with the disorder, and also you step back in the moment of the distress and, you know, call it and name it, to tame it, so to speak. And so you have to separate to some degree from the moment in order to disrupt the moment. So it's critically important for people to step. You can't change anything unless you separate yourself from it enough to recognize it. And then, you know, once you step back and get it, oh, it's happening, oh, I'm doing it, whatever it may be, then I want people to take the position of, this is exactly what I want right now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an existential position. It's the present moment. This is what's going on. And I only have two choices here. Either I accept this or I resist it. And as soon as I resist it, I'm screwed.
Yeah. So this process, I mean, what I'm loving about the nature of doing the work that I've done, because although when you say what we learned back then, I didn't actually start getting into this game until I was in my late 40s. So the really good thing was there was a whole bunch of really basic stuff I never learned, which people have said constantly, you're so lucky because you didn't have to forget it. So I kind of learned about anxiety from you. Which was very good. I took advantage of all the mistakes you made and worked on. But although
you are so smart,
yeah, I am so smart.
That's what they say.
But more praise to Reed. Here we go. But I did attend a fantastic presentation that you made in a conversation, in a dual conversation with somebody else. And they were not so keen on your slightly aggressive, slightly confronting, sometimes it's very. I know with Mum sometimes I would push her, really push her, and she would get more anxious. And I would say, see, Mum, you're more anxious than you were before. You did that by my stimulus. And she'd look at me and she'd say, oh, I did. And almost like a light switch, she'd go, I say, now make it less. And she'd go, oh, yeah. And then, yeah.
So experience is the greatest teacher.
Yeah. And so I was very, for me, it was great. But my sisters thought it was problematic because I thought it was being aggressive at things. And in this conversation, this talk you had, it was in Phoenix, I think. Mm-hmm. There was a disagreement going on. How have you found this interaction with other therapists, this disagreement with the Reed Wilson way? How have you managed to do it?
You know, I am one standard deviation beyond the mean. And I don't know whether that's to the left or the right of the mean, but I do feel like I fight against the system. If we just think about obsessive compulsive disorder, the treatment is exposure and response prevention. Well, I think it's cruel and unusual punishment what we do for people with OCD when we make them, you know, listen to these audio tapes of themselves doing these brutal things that they are afraid that they're going to do. It's cruel and unusual punishment if there's another way to do it. The other place where I tend to get a lot of pushback is in the world of mindfulness. Which is, you know, it's much, you know, with a mindful approach, it's much more like go to neutral instead of where I go is go to paradoxical, you know, ask for it. And the reason I think that that's the right thing to do is because people who are anxious and worried are too obsessive to get perspective enough to go neutral. And so when we can do this more provocative approach, have them catch on to that, then in the end, absolutely what we want to have people get to is a place of mindfulness, which is just being detached from it all. But it's the method of getting there. So I think that's probably the other biggest kind of turmoil I have in the field around this mindfulness, anti-mindfulness approach.
Instead of going to the quiet mountain to meditate, you're asking them to strap on body armor and go headlong into the fray.
Well, it's just too hard to get quiet. Think somebody doing Vipassana meditation when they're obsessing all the time. There's no conceivable way they can do it. These people are perfectionistic. They want to please the therapist. They're very self-critical. And then we start to teach them this mindfulness stuff and they, you know, fall through the cracks and then they just give up and they say, I can't do this. And so, you know, it's a little like people going into their primary care physicians and or any gatekeeper or emergency room or whatever and getting a prescription for anxiety disorders and never hearing from them the message that there are other ways besides medications to treat this stuff. And so they have side effects of the medications or they can't tolerate it or it doesn't help much. And then they just drop out of the medical field. So, I mean, I think there's problems in different arenas here that we want to try to clean up if we can. The medication gatekeeper problem of never informing people about self-help or cognitive behavioral therapy or treatment is a sin, really, in my book, a reformed Catholic.
Yeah, but it's all that strange sort of sociological idea we have in the Western world. I think, as we know, antibiotics sort of created this one cure fits all, and one cure cures all, and there's this variation. But when you're watching you work, there's a framework. This framework that you're discussing, you use, but I've never seen you do exactly the same set of processes twice. It's not like
what fun would that be?
Yeah, well, that's
I have
right.
to entertain myself.
but it's the thing that I love, which feature called client responsive. And even though there's a lot of, I might think there's a little, the therapist is working a bit too hard, but it is always individualistic. And that's the important thing as well. Even with my mum, when I was doing things, each time we did the experience, it had a variation depending on the day.
Working with me, I just come at them. I come at them hard and fast, and I push. I mean, I want to collaborate, of course, but it's like, let's get to work. First session. Oh, what do you want me to talk about? Talk about right now. Talk about your complaints right now. What's your chief symptom? I don't care about history. If we need it, we can go get it. But just let's, since I work in the way I work, let's just get going around. We don't care about how all this started. I want to know how you're maintaining it by your role. And I will try to reflect that back to you because you don't know that you're doing this. And so I can, hold the mirror up and let you see.
Right. Yeah. So that's very immediate. We're not diving into sort of the past and doing session after session, thinking about the origins. We're just dealing with maintaining symptoms.
Yeah. And if people get stuck, then we can back up as needed. Some people can't do their homework or get confused or start missing appointments or whatever, and those to me tend to be signs that we are missing something here and maybe we better back up and pump.
Yeah. Now, as much as we've just talked about, there's, everyone's an individual and there's an individual approach. There are the basic principles which are the same across the board for everybody. And so in terms of maintaining anxiety, could you give us some ideas of, what are those basic principles?
Sure. And I, again, as a cognitive therapist, if somebody comes in to see me and they say, I just have anxiety all day, my hands shake and my stomach hurts and I get headaches and I, and this whole list. And I ask them, well, what do you worry about? Well, I don't have any worries. Well, I'm sending them to their physician because I've never, except for people who haven't yet paid attention to what they're thinking, most anxiety is going to be driven by some kind of thought or at least belief. So we're going to look at that whole piece. We want to understand that pattern. We want to step back and notice it in the moment. I want to do this work, which is, again, a very big sell. And then I want to step forward and I want to, this is an aggressive sport. So I want to look for ways to, how I conceptualize it, we're talking about the two main issues is intolerance of uncertainty and what we would call anxiety sensitivity. And so I'm going to, although there's lots, little variations on all of that with people with anxiety and OCD, the workhorses are these two issues. And so I want them to be working out some ways with me collaboratively to step forward into my feared circumstance to the degree I develop some degree of uncertainty and distress about it, and then hang out. And I say one more thing around the kind of the structure is I think about this work being moment by moment. So we're talking about what do I do right now? What do I think right now? How do I respond at this moment? I want people to think about how to win the moment and just put those moments together, and so that's also another, really cornerstone of what I'm doing that seems to be pretty different than other people. Let's handle right now. What's my strategy?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that one of the many elements is Matt's talking about the nature of anxiety is you do with anxiety and OCD, I use a time reference sometimes. Like anxiety is about future issues that we're concerned about today, and OCD is about present issues we're not able to, we're managing in a peculiar way. So, and depression is like, I don't want anything to happen at all.
Think that's quite right around OCD. No. I think OCD is also future-oriented.
It's future, worried about what's going to happen when I get into that move past this. Okay. So
you can go back and ask your question in a second, but let me just say around, you know, OCD manipulates time so well. One is, you know, here's the obsession, compulsion, and it's only going to take you a moment to do this compulsion. It'll only take you a little bit. Why would you not go ahead and do this compulsion? Because, you know, bringing contamination in your home and getting your kids sick and maybe causing them to die, that seems ridiculous. You could just wash your hands for 3 minutes and you'd be okay. So it sucks time like that because that's not true, because you just multiply that, you know, 3 minute hand washing times 55 times per day. And the second way it manipulates time is, you know, it is about the future, trying to prevent this terrible future from happening. And it's a little like you might as well go ahead and do this compulsion now, because your urge for it's going to be sticking around until you finally do it. Might as well get it behind you and move on. So I just wanted to clarify around how the disorder of OCD manipulates time in very clever ways, I think.
Oh, that's brilliant. That brilliant. It extends it because I was just sort of focusing on the issue at the moment. But it'd be brilliant. Yeah, no, lovely. And when working with someone who begins this process, what are some of the interruptions you do in OCD? We've heard a couple of the things you do in anxiety. What are some of the ways how do you mess with the OCD?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, in some ways it's easier with OCD, because if you're talking about somebody who has generalized anxiety disorder, and I'm a single parent with three kids and I've been laid off, and if I don't find money by the end of the month, we might lose our apartment. That's a topic that is worth worrying about. So now I got to sort through the legitimate worry that I would call a signal that I need to, you know, it tells me I need to problem solve this. You know, I need to get, you know, get some coaching, and I need to work on my resume and so forth. And then the disorder takes that topic and uses it to nickel and dime you all day with worries. And so that's how in other anxieties, it kind of takes what is legitimate and then beats you over the head with it. With OCD, the topic that they obsess about is never relevant. It's always nothing. And so, you know, part of the way, you know, when I have, as I've been working with somebody, you know, one of the cardinal guidelines is, you know, when that thought, that obsession pops up, what I want to do is treat it as nothing and let me take actions as though there's nothing to see here. So here I am, you know, checking the front door 20 times to make sure it's locked and no one's going to break in. Now, tomorrow morning, I'm going to go practice. Maybe I'll decide I'm only going to check it 5 times and then step away. So after the 5th check, I'm going to step away and operate as though, act as though, take actions as though there's nothing to see here. So I'm going to walk down the sidewalk, get in my car, drive on to work. However, what I'm experiencing is uncertainty and distress. Now, that's how I practice. I take actions that move me as though it's nothing in order to take the hit of uncertainty. And then the piece around the uncertainty that you need to keep disconnecting is it's not uncertainty about whether the door's locked or not. This has nothing to do with the door. It's just a generic sense of this discomfort around something's not finished. I see a number of people who will say, my last therapist says, you know, maybe the door is locked, maybe the door is not locked, I can handle uncertainty. Well, to me, that's nuts to say that and to teach your client that, because that is like as though the door being unlocked is relevant. you know, and then let's extend it out. Oh, well, maybe I am a pedophile. Maybe I'm not. I can handle uncertainty. Maybe I ran somebody over in the road this morning and hit them in the ditch and they'll be dead by tomorrow and it'll be my fault. And maybe I didn't. I can handle uncertainty. So it becomes absurd when we start thinking about the topics. And I guess, I mean, that's another place where I go that's a little different than other people, which is it's you got to operate as though the topic is nothing. And with OCD, that's a powerful way to get going. It's a hard sell,
yeah,
right? Because there's a rationalization for, you know, germs or an accident. And I wasn't paying attention. I maybe done something wrong. It just goes on and on and on. But what you want to pay attention to is if it's my theme, and most people with OCD has got maybe one, maybe two or three themes. If it's my theme, I'm not sure whether I need to be paying attention to this thought or not, as this obsession, I'm going to treat it as nothing. Because if you don't get to this, like, I'm not sure which it is, I'm going to treat it as though it's nothing, then every event's going to be an exception to the rule, and you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love that film, As Good As It Gets, with Jack Nicholson. And there are a few instances we've had in a number of different aspects of psychotherapy, of disorders, is that something comes along which overrides it, which is more important, which shifts that focus. And it's exactly as you say, that it's a self-recovery because the thing that they're doing, they go, oh, that's actually not important. This is more important. And
you know, absolutely. And that happened. I got somebody right now who's going through that, of going, that, oh, now what's happening in the United States is real. What I'm doing is not real. But it has a half-life of about 20 minutes, really. Right. It's in reality, it gives them a window, you know, this little peeking through the window, but it tends to not finish the work. People really have to kick butt in order to get strong enough. OCD does not really fade away on its own in someone's lifetime. Very rare that happens, unfortunately.
Yeah, so those events, the more important events, can become a wedge in the door.
Yes, absolutely. You can have a little breakthrough at that point and then go, okay, well, that's it. Forget it.
Oh, cool.
Right. Can I just jump back a little bit when we were talking about anxiety and the initial triggers? And you said, you know, someone will say, you know, you'd say, are you worried about something? They say, oh, no, we're not worried about anything, but I've got all these symptoms. So how often is it that somebody will be unconscious of what the real worry is? And so they're just having these symptoms, but then you've got to sort of really bring to the surface, bring to conscious awareness what the true worries are.
Well, Matt, the unfortunate part of that question is that those people tend not to come into treatment.
Right.
They tend to go to their physician and go through some kind of pharmacological change or an intention around medications because, you know, I'm just an anxious person. And it's true, you know, some people have the nervous system of a racehorse and some people have the nervous system of a turtle. and so that is true, but that's the bad news. I don't get it a lot.
Okay.
I really don't. Even if they come in, you know, in the first session with that, usually within a couple sessions, we can start to peel that back and get a sense of some of that stuff. And then you're just going back to kind of psychotherapy stuff to uncover that stuff. And now we talk about history and, you know, what happened in the family and so forth. And then we tend to try to put together some themes like, I wonder if it's this instead of that. I think one of the things that I'm trying to do is to have them look at the problem in such a way as to question their solution.
Right.
So, you know, if you've got somebody who's afraid to fly, and it turns out that first flight they had and where they had a panic attack, they were actually flying off to visit their parents and they were in a conflictual relationship with their parents. Well, if we can uncover that, then they can go, oh, well, wait a minute. I misattributed my panic attack to the turbulence on the flight, really, maybe it was about my unconsciously starting to get worried about dealing with my dad, if we have another fight when I get out to California to visit him. So some of those things pop up just along the way where we tend to get stuck. You know, you start to help somebody and they, you know, doing what they need to do and it's not working out for them. That's, as I was saying earlier on, that's when you kind of step back and start looking around.
Yeah, this thing, stuckness, is a great opportunity. It's a great presentation of now's where you go in a different direction. Now's that's the treatment telling you.
Yeah.
So we've had this fabulous discussion that's taken 30 minutes has gone in about a flash. So this is my segue into Reed. Do you have any final, you know, what's a wrap up? What's a sort of, is there a little summary or a little final point that we've missed that's important?
No, I just think I'll go back to what I said before. This is difficult, but I do think there's structures that we can, I mean, this is why this last book I wrote, I talk about all the anxiety disorders and OCD as having a common challenger. And I really do think that that is true. And so we can look more simply at things and what our structure is and how we respond to them. And that can be immensely helpful to us. And that's just what I'm trying to do, is pass that on to consumers.
And what's the title of the book?
Stopping the Noise in Your Head, The New Way to Overcome Anxiety and Worry.
Fantastic. Well, we'll give a big plug on that for our and to the website and to all the YouTube and all the bits and pieces for everybody.
Dr. Reed Wilson, it's been wonderful having you on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Matt.
We'll see you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Another fantastic talk, Matt. Yes. That's really good. I mean, we talked all around the place, but there are those fundamental elements you see, and I love that one is get yourself sorted out, then mess with things.
No. What's the pattern? And then
mess with it. What's the pattern and mess with it? There's so many of these intersections with lots of other information. And of course, we have lots of other information that you can check out the intersections with, both with the magazine, which of course we bring out every month, and our Science of Psychotherapy Academy, where you can go in. Now, if you're a subscriber, then of course you can get access to a whole bunch of things just for the one price. But then you can also get things at one off purchases. So that's we'd love people to be as involved as they can, and it helps us keep doing these podcasts too.
Yes, if you appreciate what we're doing here on the Science of Psychotherapy, we'd love to have your support. Become a subscriber on the Science of Psychotherapy, and you'll get more content than you can poke a stick at her.
Yes, that's right. And we all know how therapists like to poke things with a stick.
That's right.
So come poke us with a stick and you'll get a lot of satisfaction.
All right. Okay. Thanks so much, Richard. It was wonderful. I do encourage you to jump onto the landing page for this podcast. We'll have all the links to Reed Wilson's stuff on anxiety and his book. And so great resources there to check out. And thanks again for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast.
Yes. And see you next week.
See you then.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.